Welcome to our Fire the Pastor poetry reading. I'm your moderator, Tyler Chadwick. I'm going to introduce each of the poets who will be reading. How many of you in here have heard of this? If you have a spouse up here, I'm sure you've heard of it. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about its inception, and then we'll have each of the poets read some of their work, and then we'll have a question and answer after that. So, right here we have Neil Aitken. He is the author of The Lost Country of Sight, which won the 2007 Philip Levine Poetry Prize. And he's also the founding editor of The Boxcar Poetry Review, which is an online journal for poetry. He publishes some excellent stuff, so check it out. His poetry has appeared or is forthcoming in The Collagist, Crab Orchard Review, Iron Horse Literary Review, Ninth Letter, Rhino, and elsewhere. He was once a computer games programmer in his former life, and he is completing his PhD in literature and creative writing at USC. You can find him online at neil-aitken.com. And then next, to my left, we have Karen Kelsey, who is the editor of Victorian Violet Press, which is another online poetry magazine, and White Violet Press, which is a publishing company that focuses on chapbooks that showcase formalist poetry. Her work has appeared in a variety of journals, including Maiso Kamin, The Lyric, The Hypertexts, and The Rain Tam Review. She's published 5 chapbooks, a full-length collection, and has received multiple Pushcart Prize nominations. And on the end there, we have Elisa Pulido, whose writing has appeared in numerous journals, including River Styx, The Ledge, The North American Review, and if you know what these journals are, you might get bonus points. The North American Review, Margie, another Chicago magazine, The Tour House Newsletter, The New Guard, Literal Latte, and Rhino. Her work has also appeared in Interchange in the New Welsh Review in the UK, and she actually just took her qualifying exams.
I got the orals on next Friday.
She's in between qualifying exams for her PhD in Religions of North America, right here at CGU. And here we have Laura Stott, whose poems have been published in Hayden's Ferry Review, Crab Creek Review, Quarterly West, and Bellingham Review. She got her MFA from Eastern Washington University, worked as a managing editor for Willow Springs, and she teaches online for Weber State University. It's a good school. It's my alma mater.
All right.
And she's currently working on a poetry and art collaboration and show with her sister, who is a visual artist. So apparently she has a creative family. Last but not least, we have Holly Welker, who has a PhD in English literature from the University of Iowa. Her poetry and prose have appeared in publications ranging from The New Era to The New York Times, and from Best American Essays to Bitch. It's a far cry from The New Era. Fire in the Pasture, We're all represented in this anthology.
You should introduce yourself.
I'm Tyler Chadwick. I edited this anthology. I'm almost a doctoral candidate in English, in the teaching of English. Someday I'll have that degree, I hope. If I pay them enough money, they'll give it to me, right?
You're studying where?
At Idaho State University. So, that's me. Fire in the Pasture. How many of you have heard of Harvest? Contemporary Mormon poems. In 1985, Eugene England and Dennis Clark published this anthology of around 60 poets who were writing from or out of a Mormon religious tradition. That was obviously over 20 years ago. And in that time, there have arisen a lot of really excellent poets, but there wasn't anywhere that they were collected. So, under the auspices of Peculiar Pages, which is an independent publisher of Mormon literature, I was asked by Theric Jepson, if I would like to ask some poets to be in an anthology to update Harvest, because it was about time somebody put together all this great poetry that was going on. So I started the Mammoth Collection effort about 2 years ago. Oh, almost 3 years ago. And 82 poets later, they all said yes. Thank goodness. And, well, I had to reject a few.
And a few said no.
And a few said no. That is also correct. 82 poets are included in this. They range with from a contribution of from 2 to 5 poems each. So there are over 500 pages of really excellent poetry in this. You can buy it online through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or you can order it through a brick-and-mortar bookstore as well.
And so have you made a nickel?
I have seen nada yet.
But that was the point.
But it's all for the passion, right?
My husband is all about that.
Yes. Yes, luckily it's not completely my day job. So, a little bit about the title. I'm going to read, first of all, I'll start off with the title poem, which was by Doug Talley. His poem is titled Finding Place. A fire in the pasture undulates, of blue and white and yellow flower. A fire like a snake, iridescent by sunlight and undulant in the wind. Here, one will understand the Nazarene's joy, awash in the lilies of his own field, a spicery of uncommon radiance in a common hour, rising from the dark spelunculer sod. Consider, he said, simply consider. Flowers catching light like the scales of a serpent's skin, a yellow apple sun delicious to the taste, and temptations to joy irrepressible. The kingdom of heaven found on earth is like a pasture, a strange little kingdom full of spicery, the undulant and spelunculer, and all other words by which we frame it. In this life, we find the peaceable kingdom within, then above, beneath, and all around. What can a person driven by grandiosity know of the quiet, hidden God found here? I thought that was a good way to frame this anthology, that it takes up the religious experience and the aesthetic experience with religion. And it uses a lot of the metaphors we often use to interact with God, fire, pasture, things like that. And so, obviously we're not driven by grandiosity. This is a huge crowd we've gathered together. But we appreciate you being here to listen to us read from our passion, from some of our poems. We'll start off with Neil. We'll go in alphabetical order. So if I hope you can get that right, I'll try and remind you. We have 10 minutes, starting now.
I'm going to hop a little bit between the anthology and some poems from my book and some newer pieces. This first poem is actually the first poem in my book, and it's entitled In the Long Dream of Exile. You are counting the dark exit of crows in the rearview mirror or from the top of an overpass looking back into the last flames of cloud. Your car, steel to the world of flint, rests listless with its windows wide, the stars slipping in and settling down for the night. Now, what you could not leave rides in boxes heavy with numbers and places you've already turned into poems. There's nothing left in your pockets, your clothes worn down to this list of miles taking you out of the known earth. Outside your open window, the dark repeats like the wind in late fall, twisting the names of familiar back roads into a long rope of sighs. You could lower yourself down with such longing. It could be a woman or a young girl, the way the light clings to that body like a sheet of immaculate heat, invisible to the eye, but something you are certain, something that must be on the verge of love. I grew up kind of all over the world, but a lot of my childhood was spent in Saskatchewan, Canada, which is notorious of being one of the flattest places on earth. I'll save the joke for later, but there's a great joke that goes with that. This poem's entitled Furials. Pulling through Montana in the snow, we cling to the taillights of the last car blurring back into the darkness. Like the inside of a coffin, my father says, as if knowing the exact shade, the Dead Sea, lying stiff, frozen eyes peering up through closed lids. He shifts in his seat, watches the road disappear, thinks again of dying and the burials we've seen, his father's simple reduction to ashes. How small the urn, how light for a man that stood 6'3", carried a boy on his shoulders, lived on trains as a youth, picked apples as a man. This past summer, watching him thin to disappearing, blurring out lines between lives, my father trying to return pieces, fragments, time, the body burning, the dark smells of crematoriums, funeral homes, and pale-faced lawyers. Something merges, ends, and begins. My father placing the ashes back into the air, offerings to the skies, to the seas, unaware how Buddhist he is at this moment, how the faint sound of bagpipes echoes, how the ashes fall, catching light, reflecting something back into the silence, the dark birth of the sun coming into view. This next poem comes from a newer project, which revolves around computers and technology, and kind of reinvents some of the language that we're accustomed to using as programmers in a more lyrical way. This one's called pointer, which is a special type of variable that holds the address of another variable. Not the thing itself, but a hand gesturing to where it lies in memory, like when we say hopper and mean any room viewed from without, any couple made distant by sulfur light and shadow, the angled turn of bodies which do not come face to face, but lean awkwardly on tables, across keys, at the unopened window where night bends like a palm under the weight of all that is impossible to touch. A numbered stall out in the parking lot, in the lower levels of the tower by our building, between the lines at the side of the road and what they imply. This insistence on fire and exhaust, how smoke rises to our lips. Even now, ash speaks to ash, to the names of my father and his father, to what remains in the wind and on the ways for days after an eruption, to the week we hid in our homes after the fall of New York, the trees which break the frosted earth awash in the color of salt, our hands caught between lapwing and sorrow, between iron vein and needle, between want and want. Next piece makes a reference to a historical figure by the name of Charles Babbage, who some of you may not know him, but he was a mathematician in the 19th century who invented the precursor to the modern computer, which would have led the computer revolution then, but the British government cut the funding, so never
finished. Typical British.
Hasn't changed, right? Yeah. This is called Loop. Here is the key and the kite, and the string that winds its way to heaven, or so we suppose, one thing circling back on another, returning. The pattern is always set in advance. The corner turned, we find the same storefronts, the same blank-eyed windows of banks, not destiny, just our inability to escape ourselves and what we've written. Rain returning to the river, lightning to the hand that calls it home, all late summer, the sparrows in the dark skies, the rise and fall of kingdoms of waves on the lake shore, the body of the world breathes in and out, and we believe, as Babbage says, that what we've seen in the past will somehow determine what comes next. How his guest hovered by the engine in the front parlor, churning its continual flow of numbers into a miracle, when at last its tally leapt seemingly unbidden by a millionfold. The scope of the spiral larger than any had imagined, the rules different, unknown, the same way I loop back to the place in memory where it begins, where it might end, you in the courtyard lit by the laundry room's glow, how your face turns in the light, and half-formed words stir in the fire of my iron-plated belly, as if I were part machine, part prairie blaze, with a heart full of gears and smoked honeysuckle, a mouth that only speaks in steam, the language of vapor and longing, and a kiss that circles above our heads and never quite descends. This one's entitled Memory. In the past, we wrote things down on cards, made of braille of absence, holes where something should be known or recalled. We constructed stories out of old addresses, linked numbers together in a chain, assembled a patchwork hovel from whatever was left over, discarded newspapers, broken frames, loose bits of hair and clay, wooden planks and nails, till it rose like a large tenement filled with transients and strangers in tattered clothes with tattered names, the hallways lined with an array of refugee suitcases from the last war scattered haphazardly like shoes along an old rail line that runs into the sea. What is memory, and who is it that slips in at these odd hours working late into the night to compile a map through this hoarder's den of detail, this warren of notes woven into a tapestry of cricket song and firelight, and every moment we've buried in the name of loss and compassion? Who is it that stirs upstairs in our mind, in my mind, moves through the darkened space, searching the drawers for a key to wind a clock in a house that no longer exists? Here, my father is alive again, once more, driving through the mountain pass, stopping at the place where the road cuts clean through the coal veins and leaves the remnants of trees in the shale exposed, the imprint of things already gone, turned to a dark line, a scribble in the stone. How a boy in this moment lifts each one to his eye, then to his ear, as if to hear the still small voice of the wind in the lungs of the earth. When I awake, there is always a silence that slips through the walls at dawn, lurks in the middle drawer of a small chest in my room, where a machine rests unmoved, its tape unheard, though it holds all that remains of my father's voice, now the sum of mere data, the magnet of the world endlessly inscribes, then lets go, how the heart orbits each silence like a small moon, revolving around what it cannot leave and what it cannot remember. I think I'm going to close with this last poem from the book. I dream my father on the shore. Begins with an epigraph from a line from Wendell Berry, who writes in his poem, In the Country of Marriage, "What I am learning to give you is my death." Outside, beneath the light of late October's candled sky, the weave of ash and maple burns. We stand silent on the graveled shore. My father lifts his father's ashes from its urn, a strangely heavy thing, he seems to say, his arms swaying and casting out into the long dark as if to throw a line, while we wait for some sound, a wave, whatever marks the distance between a father and a son. And when night comes, it comes without a tread, without a word, the stars flickering in their endless retreat, more distant and sure than before, do nothing while the shadows continue to fill the trees with their cast-off clothes. The harvest is long past. The apples have fallen to the orchard floors. Even my father turning to go is almost lost to the reeds already in his path. His figure no more than a pattern of light, a memory of a road that winds through the darkness to our waiting ride home. Thank you.
Karen, I think that's you.
Okay. This one is from the book. I'm going to
do a few that are from Fire in the Pasture and a few that are more recent. Between the ages of 18 and 30, I moved back and forth to Alaska 3 times from Southern California and couldn't seem to... I liked summers, but I hated the winters. And when I got up there, I wanted to be in California. And when I was in California, I wanted to be in Alaska. So this poem is about, actually, to remind me why I hate Alaska. It's called How to Break a Northern Spell. Remember your expensive basket of fuchsias the moose ate before sunup, and the fat mosquitoes that hovered around your head when the bedroom lights went out. Recall how the kids went to school each morning beneath streetlights that barely lit the sidewalk. Count the hours they wouldn't go to bed in the summer because the sun never left the sky. Keep in mind the snowsuits you zipped and unzipped so the children could pee every 2 hours. Think about the dog in his muddy kennel, car locks that froze, the Chinook wind that blew your neighbor's balcony into your yard. Erase the feel of static electricity zapping your finger every time you flicked a light switch. Imagine the scent of a wet wool blazer. Pack all those memories into a tarnished little locket, rub it like a counter charm, dig your toes into the California sand. This poem is about learning the art of walking. And growing up in Southern California, where everyone drives to their destination, I was really surprised when I started going back to England with my husband, and we saw entire families walking around and around in circles for recreation. They would just no destination at all. And if we ever go to an art gallery or we go sightseeing, I'm always the one who, I'm miles ahead of everyone, tapping my foot, and he's looking at every little detail. So that's what this poem is about, gathering moss. You always stopped for no apparent reason whenever we walked into town. It drove me crazy. Every slightest change in season, you'd find a little coppice in the grove or see a beetle laboring across the fallen leaf. I had to break my pace, transform into a stone that gathered moss. I couldn't keep annoyance off my face. And then my knee decided I should learn to stroll with leisure, letting pain be teacher. I spotted Lily's pale asparagus fern, looked up to see the pear tree's every feature. A faster stride? It almost seems unholy. How glad I am you still like walking slowly. This is a poem from the book, and one day I had several hours where I wanted to go write a poem, and it always happens when I have free time, I can't think of anything to write, and I was determined I was going to come up with something. So I went into my office and I slit the blinds and I made some herbal tea and lit a candle, and a poem appeared. So it's been revised quite a few times. It's called Divining a Lost Summer. I pushed aside the papers in my tray and culled the wilted leaves from my bouquet set on the shelf. I've lit a candle, made a pot of tea and scones with marmalade, the kind you liked. The blinds are slit. A cool north wind has melted palms into a spool of endive colored fronds. It's quiet here. I close my eyes, blurred images appear. The room recedes. I sip the bitter tea and think about a time by Peyton C. Your gauze-like scent clings to the walls. Despair and giddy memories return. I swear I hear a gull in Jody Bell's refrain. They both dissolve like sandhills in the rain. And this is the last one. I wrote it recently. I think it's probably more typical of most of the poetry I write now. I've changed about 18 months ago to, I don't do much free verse anymore, so most of it's formalist. It's called Winter Needlepoint. Here comes the cold time, holly, pine, and yew, low grass-laced hills crisscross in winter white. Dark threads of clouds stretch sugar plum and blue across a canvas sky of fraying light. The frost arranges crystals on a limb, flakes falling reappear as snow on snow, like French knots sewn above the tree root's rim that stencil little patterns to and fro. The frozen oak is filled with mistletoe, its yellow berries unconcealed by leaf. They offer fruit for robin, thrush, and crow. It makes me think of emptiness and grief, reminds me of a summer filled of yarrow and everything that bloomed before the chill. December brings a tapestry of sorrow with knots pulled through a surface of goodwill.
Lisa?
Aren't you reading yet, Tyler?
I'm going to read last because I'm not going to read all my own poems. I'm going to read some other poets, too.
All right. Okay, well, then I'll read something from the book first. I'll read a poem called Dog Walking at Night in a New Neighborhood. I wrote this poem in response to a piece I had read at school here. It's from David Hall's book, Worlds of Wonder. He was talking about Samuel Sewall, who was actually one of the judges in the Salem witch trials. And in his journal, in his diary, he talks about the whole world is, he sees portents everywhere and everything. So I took a walk in my neighborhood with my dog, which is what it's called, dog walking at night in a new late neighborhood, and I tried to see the supernatural and everything in my neighborhood. And this poem was a gift to the Claremont Mormon Council. We're sitting in this room because so many nice Mormon donors have given money to the Mormon Studies program at Claremont, and this was my gift to them. I gotta see what time it is. Okay. I open the door only to discover this place too gets dark at night, and as I have not yet made the acquaintance of the street's bushes, and since they balloon blackly either side of the road like rumors, I walk Max down the center of the street. Across town, church bells peal from the Cathedral of San Juan, and just as I decide to brave the sidewalk through the Valley of Shadows, a fire truck, sirenless but with lights flashing, rolls up the street, which can only mean that judgment has come to one of my new neighbors. I walk the other way through an unseasonable scent of phlox, which rises from an invisible bed, and think about the bodies of saints, which supposedly smell like roses even in death. I imagine these particular neighbors with their unseasonably fragrant flocks must be saintly people, and just as I determine to make their acquaintance, I am warned by the runoff of night watering as it slips through a drain in the curb and showers underground. Undoubtedly, this neighborhood too has its underbelly. Down the street, a blue fairy skitters towards us. At close range, she morphs into a battery-operated light dangling from the collar of a large boxer who snarls and strains at his leash in an effort to confront Max. A hooded figure pulls him past. I walk on, still pondering this latest lesson, when the world's stateliest street lamp, a fluted column topped with a translucent urn, allows us into its circle. I pause and gaze upward into its benediction, then turn towards home. Above us, the moon has been bitten off by thirds, the last third still clinging to the night. What can it mean that tonight, of all nights, I should experience a two-thirds loss in the moon? I have no answer. At the front door, while fumbling with unfamiliar keys, I notice the Schoenfelds have left their mezuzah nailed to the frame. So this was a house in Israel. Me too, Lord, watch me too, when I sit at home, when I walk along the way, when I lie down, and when I rise up. I'll read, this one was published, Claremont published this in their newsletter. It's called Angel Repairs the Blinds. It's a kind of a little, sort of a sonnet. Angel came today to repair the blinds in our bedroom, which had stubbornly refused to rise. We hadn't seen the backyard for months. We were amazed. The grass was still green. Thank you, automated sprinklers, for your unflinching regularity. The pool was still blue. Thank you, Coastal Pool Service. Naked ladies bloomed at the border of the yard. Must thank you, God. Jack and Maggie, the neighbor's dog, still snarled through the fence. No need to thank anyone. Surely this is the job of angels, isn't it? To restore faith, heal the blind, enlighten our views, or to proclaim, without you, the world goes on. This is called Emma Waiting. I was kind of really thrilled to see the opening session of this conference because I'm preparing for my qualifying exams. I had to read Elizabeth Fiorenza Schussler's work on In Memory of Her, when they're talking about rewriting women back into the Bible because they've sort of been written out, and making Christianity important, salient to women by restoring their heritage. So I have written Emma Smith back into the story of the Hill Cumorah, though I did do 24 pages of natural history research, so whether or not this happened, I know that the insects and the phase of the moon are all correct. Okay, Emma Waiting, September 22nd, 1827. One. It's after midnight on a moonless night when the holy man and his bride arrive in a one-horse wagon at the base of the hill. Up in the Canamy Cumorahs, Katie did strum a potent meditation for honeymooners, or perhaps even holy men who have been called into the night by angelic beings. The holy man hands his wife the reins, leaves her in starlight in a wagon borrowed without permission. Two. Hoping for grace, benedictions, powers, plates, the holy man begins his steep climb into God's realm. His wife hears him rustle through Indian pipe and lady fern. Beneath the katydid's clamor, she imagines the chirping of tiny shrews interrupted by his footfall in the underlitter. Three. On the holy man goes, higher and higher. The wife of the holy man imagines him weaving through aspen, white pine, and beech. She hears a porcupine chat out a warning. She imagines the holy man jumping aside. And finally, when she thinks he must be somewhere near the top of the hill, she imagines the holy man parting tall millet grass and stepping into a hilltop clearing. In expectation, the wife of the holy man searches the starlit tree line for signs. Low-lying clouds, phosphorescent, sudden breezes, thunder. She sees nothing. Hears the horse munching roadside weeds. Four, an hour goes by. The katydids fall silent. At least, thinks the holy man's wife, at least it's the beginning of autumn. Mosquitoes and deer flies are not what they were. She stretches, tries to step down from the wagon and startles something that hisses. She retreats to her seat where she prays for the holy man. Five. Another hour and it's cooler now. Dew begins to collect on the bonnet and shawl of the holy man's wife. Her feet are cold. She envies deer mice nesting snugly in trunks, finches roosting close to each other. Where, she asks, where is the holy man? A hoot owl asks a different question. Who? Who marries a holy man? Six. The stars have dimmed and there is still no sign of the holy man. His wife portends her future in a litany of roadside weeds, gypsy weed, henbit nettles, old witch panic, nightshade. Seven. Hours ago, the wife of the holy man gave off, hoping to hear the voice of God, but she yearns for the voice of the holy man. The reins grow heavy in her hands, no longer hearing the creak of wagon box or swish of horsetail. She dozes upright. Eight. At last it is dawn. Songbirds trill, chirp, warble, exult. Wake up, wake up. Another holy man descends from his mount with a new covenant. The wife of the holy man stirs. Though she doesn't yet hear him, though she doesn't yet see him, she feels saplings give way to his touch. Pheasants startled by beauty. So let me see what time it is. Okay, I'm going to read some wild things that I have written lately. Well, actually, not really lately. I'm having such a struggle between the right and left side of my brain at present, but that will be overcome soon. I took a class in Wittgenstein's Tractatus, so I used a few of his aphorisms as springboards for poems. And here's one. The world is all that is the case. Like the case of the missing digit, or the case of the dubious daddy, or the case of the vanishing maiden, what we have in the world is a case, a puzzlement, a riddle, but nonetheless all that we have. Take it, pain in your jaws, crunch of carrot, cold gale, scent of bergamot, taste of olive. Take these because they are clues to your case. Suitcase, typewriter case, gun case, all cases belong to the one great case. Let this be a lesson. Love your case while you can. The future is an empty case. Whatever your current case, it is the only case, the Ur case, the world. And, okay, I have 1 minute left, so I'm going to read kind of a little bit of a vulgar poem. I'm sorry. This is called We Picture Facts to Ourselves. As a schoolboy, Mahler learned heaven with its steaming bowls of asparagus soup, with its platters of roasted duck served up by buxom women wearing dirndls and blonde braids. It was a Bierstein eschatology. As a schoolgirl, I pictured Cleopatra, nude, freshly oiled, sleek as the asp she was stroking. She had one foot on earth and eyes open to heaven. I pictured Genghis Khan grasping a pork roast with both hands, pausing now and then to slap bottoms and pinch tits in his Mongol mogul paradise. I pictured the Buddha floating out the front door of his home with his eyes half closed, two fingers raised on his right hand, imperturbable, impassible, too holy now for his wife and kids. Always the facts impossibly lost in the picture. If you must view heaven, take away faces and foods, names and places. Heaven is not your current case.
Am I next? Okay. Okay, I'm going to start with one from the anthology and then some others. The girl with no hands stole a silver pear from His Majesty's orchard, and the gardener saw it, believed she was an angel, the way she tilted her head back and stretched her neck to the sky to eat. Her hair hung like silk curtains, and in the moonlight, how could he not fall in love with her? How could he betray this love and tell this secret with the time to count each fruit, each destined for their numbering? It was a story the gardener couldn't explain but had to account for. So the gardener and the king waited in hiding for the maiden, and when she appeared, hunger was in the girl's every step. They dared not speak, but watched her as moths lightly played around their faces. Are you of this world? If I am a dream, then I am a dove. Be my queen, I will make you hands. And the gardener wept, and the king kept what was never his to keep. I've been working with, well, they're coming. But that was sort of it. For a while, I was obsessed with Grimm's fairy tales and kind of sent me into this whole mythy fairy tale exploration. This next poem I'll read is, it's titled The Dreaming Youths. In the room of illuminated manuscripts, the books appear to be floating like they would in a dream. A dark room in the Museum of Life, after visiting with childhood friends as children still. And at the end of a hallway is a room full of books displayed in glass cases. They appear to be tourists, old and young, from all over the world, holding cameras, studying pages none of us can read. Their faces reflect in the glass, floating on the other side. Expressions, the faces become part of the exhibit. Everyone whispers in this room, so that's what you do. This is the future. We lose the people we know, recognize strangers as friends, and find our parents in the corner with a book open to Cain and Abel, kneeling at the altar, and two heads of God drawn in the sky. You find a manuscript titled Sacred Spring, and the page Fish Blood. Klimt has drawn nudes floating in water with the mythical fish, in utter abandon. Adam and Eve leaving the garden. So many centuries are written by hand and paint, the creation of the world in gold leaf. Do you see it there? All we have left under glass, the story told forever, let there be light. That was an experience I had at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, and while I was there in the Room of Illuminated Manuscripts, it's so beautiful, you know, all these beautiful books and these glass cases, and as I was walking around, I just, you know, I felt it, like I knew it was a poem, and I think I was scared to write it, I finally got around to it about 6 months after that, but, okay. This next poem is titled Migration. There's another migration poem in Fire in the Pasture, but it's titled, I think, Across the Mojave Desert. I did a whole series of these migration poems, and it was because I, for 8 years, went back and forth to Alaska also. No. Yeah, so when you said that, we'll have to talk more about it. Yeah. So I was migrating for a good portion of my life, and, well, anyway, the last, I guess, 10 years or so, and so I was sort of in this mode and thinking about the nature of migration. This is one of those poems. The girls lost in an ocean of desert, where earth plateaus, dries, and hides creatures under crust and sleep. In the desert, the girl discovers a full moon and secret tides, places where it is high and where it is low. Everything is alive at night with snakes and birds with wide eyes. Wind is determined. Everything is shaped to the sound of sand. The girl watches her feet as she picks her way around one prickly plant to another. The desert blooms during her stay. For a while, she feels at home and adores the Mariposa lilies, the cacti blossoms in brilliant colors, so much pink. The ocotilla sways with orange fingertips. She finds one that is 20 feet tall, inspects the bony nature of what you would call limbs. Veins run through the desert's heart. She follows a tortoise. Doesn't go very far, but farther than you would think. She learns much about burrows and bumpy, dry elbows. Thinks, one doesn't really need to leave home. As she falls asleep, she dreams about what life used to be outside, all glass and plastic, plush seats, rows upon rows of waxed fruit, her reflection everywhere. So she dreams she doesn't exist anymore. Her own footsteps erased, the way she travels on rock, the way she walks for miles to avoid cryptobiotic soil, whole ecosystem sustained, how fragile life is. All is not lost. I have two more. How am I doing on time? Am I okay? I actually didn't even look. Okay. This one's titled Relics. In this story, Hermano's grandson swings on the hammock and lists what to discover in the jungle. Crocodile, vipers, sharks, big cats, armadillo, tejon. Next door, the cartel plays volleyball. These youth bring broken guns for fixing. Here, story changes everything. The devil's tail burns a deep gash as he skulks, and white lilies offer their gangly, star-like bodies out of the river, while boys off trail hide their hearts as deep in the forest as they can. We won't know what to find until we see trees wrap themselves around the heart of earth and skin of mountains. Hermano Villa brings us to the ancient rock where the devil dragged his tail when he crawled out of the river, shows us flowers and sun carved above the signature, entire stone face an ancient page. I realize as I rest in a spooned out space, this is the cold belly of sacrifice. Okay, and I'm going to end on another, I guess, a fairy tale-ish one. And Jake, would you say the title? The title's in Spanish, and my accent is horrible, and I always butcher it.
La Unión.
Thank you. Okay. In this story, the moon is absent, but in this country, the moon used to chase young families holding hands and singing in the night on their way to watch sea turtles come in from the ocean, glistening reptiles moving with slow wisdom to bury eggs in sand. Everyone felt the luck of attention. Now, trails disappear as every creeping thing stretches its fingers with fear. A poor village boy whose beautiful mother told stories and always smelled like sweet corn This boy was told if one could understand the iguana and crocodile speech, and they only spoke at night, they would have wisdom and wealth all their days. So the boy waited for the longest night of the year and no moon. He wore his darkest shirt, hid from robbers, hiding in the streets, though there was nothing they would take from him. He hid from policemen piled in trucks with loaded guns, from snakes dangling from trees. The wild cats watched him go. Flowers closed their eyes, and the bat moths fluttered after the black space of his shadow. The boy followed road, trail, jungle to the fence that kept crocodiles in and village out. The mangrove swamp sang with everything nocturnal. He pressed his face to metal, locked his fingers around and listened. Fireflies teased the air, fit his toes into irregular spaces, felt his heart beat like no wild boar running behind him, over the top and in. The boy crept to the water's edge and waited. The iguana's eyes, crocodile's nightly grin. Trees, strange shadows in the shadows. The boy found comfort in the sound of crickets. One crawled across his leg. He could hear the ocean and river run against each other, not too far away, not really all that vast moving glass. The boy even heard the voice of round stones in the waves when the ocean breathed back in. So much, the boy almost spoke out, but then the iguanas climbed out of the trees, horned manes, like some ancient animal refused from heaven. No one wrote it down. Long toes, striped tails, bright green bodies turned jade against the stars, one after another. In that moment, the orange one, the giant, slowly with her great iguana mouth, pulled out the heart of the boy. And the crocodile, his two eyes rose over the thin surface of water and watched as witness before slipping back under the mirror of stairs. The orange iguana, looking like gold in the light dark creates, took the heart to the top of the trees, and the others followed, full on sacrifice and desire. But then the surprising thing happened. Not that the boy still smiled or that a secret passed from one family to another, but the heart of the heart was given away, was offered up even, to the great sloth of the trees. And as it passed from mouth to claw, the sloth carried it for what seemed a lifetime, to that place in the jungle, in the mountains, where pure hearts are kept, where there is no name or country, where snakes can't sniff them out, can't feel their heat, because butterflies flutter about them wildly, and flowers are red with sweetness and rich nectar, and no one dies, no one can.
Literary nonfiction. I like the stories people tell about themselves. I'm interested in I'm interested in a lot of things. And I arrived at nonfiction because I realized that it was a lot like poetry but without line breaks. And within nonfiction, I'm especially interested in self-portraiture. And I write a lot of self-portraits, both in poetry and prose, and this poem is called Self-Portrait as Hungry Moon. Bully for you, a tavern wench sporting tints firm and perky as the Grand Tetons hands you a cupcake with pink sprinkles and positions a conical yellow party hat on your head, then fingers your earlobe and tells you there will be carousing till night drops off like a coastal shelf and everyone splashes drowsily in an open sea of misplaced car keys and hastily shed underwear. Okay, so you never asked for a seat on a slab of oak or sandstone, and you don't look good in regalia. Still, when some comely minx offers to paint your fingernails, you don't pull away your hand. Above my desk is an illustration torn from a magazine of a self-interested nude straddling the corner of a bed. She reaches calmly to pull the bed sheets jumbled on the floor out of disarray. The room behind her is redolent with her various yearnings and quiet contentments. I keep her where I can see her because I admire her strong wrists, her amply capable thighs, and her expression of inward expectation. She's thinking she's hungry, I'll bet, contemplating what to have for dinner. She's not prone to extravagant outbursts of regret, and when the script calls for her to dress and depart, she will, glad to go before things get ugly. She'd no more carry resentment or false hope than she'd haul someone else's birth control pills around in her handbag. You invited me to this party, then left me alone with the punch bowl. You think I'm drained as a bathtub, cast off like anonymous panties, a bad saddle on a cranky horse. But really, I'm just hungry and deciding what I'd like for dinner, how much meat I want to tear between my teeth. This is called Here. I'm not looking for space. I want density, density, density. Experience up against itself, experience, experience, experience. Sound embedded in sound, harmonious or not, but layers, repetitions, swirls. You embedded in me like a splinter in a palm or a filling in a tooth. My prayers, heavy as gravity. Please let us always feel the weight of a sky that presses us together and down into the world. This is a poem about losing my virginity. And it's about the martyrdom of Joan of Arc, which tells you something about the experience. It's called Christian Art. St. Paul, who is often painted balding and glum, told us, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. Christine, who's an idiot and not really my friend, called L'Église de Jeanne d'Arc, the Jeannie d'Arc Church, which is cool, actually, in its own particular way. The theme is particular vices, strands of beads and heavy brass earrings, skulls, roses wilted in a vase, pomegranates oozing red juice, a map of the world with America, a yellow bar surrounded by blue, your reflection in a mirror because St. Paul also wanted all of us dressed in the armor of light, which Jeanne d'Arc put on in the end, and perhaps it protected her, and perhaps it only hurt. It has to be enough to make you feverish and ill, but in a good way, really, in a way that your cheeks are always flushed and nothing ever tastes good enough to eat, so you forget how to swallow and remember only to sing, and that's how you generate your own astonishment at the tangled way life funnels down to a dark, painful source of envy and praise. Well, that's that. Somewhere some people are singing Gregorian chants a cappella in monkish tenor voices, and if I could find anything to envy, I'd envy it with anxious deliberation. I'd praise light so busy and abundant, its surplus breeds wonder and pleasure and overindulgence and ends in a sudden flash of blindness that never goes away. This is called social realism. In the 12th century, people needed both their hands and not just for counting. Prayer had already been invented, plague had too. A grouchy, grungy potter fashioned a terracotta drum for a terracotta soldier to bang in the revolt against oppression. But the drum came out of the kiln etched with what the potter knew immediately were the two faces of God. So he sold it to a traveling merchant for 7 bags of gold and a very healthy milk cow, and that was the end of that. This is called Underpinnings. I don't write that much poetry anymore. I'm trying to write a novel, but this is one of my more recent poems. Underpinnings. Listening to the equinox. Not enough brass, not enough baritone, not enough bassoon. I play with translation software. I won't cast his bust in bronze or even plaster becomes. I will not cast him in the ancient bronzes, even medicinal plaster bust. I'm just bummed this morning is sensibly rendered. In the morning went begging. I've decided I'm not in love with him because I've decided I fall in love with him, just like that. While I'm going to make myself a cheeseburger, doesn't really change. What is this calculation of costs? The ocean, not the sand on the beach. A piece of string, not a string of pearls. A painful submitting, not the joints of on a hand. Duller color, fuller dolor. The canopy is all one thing, swirled upon itself like a statement of fact. Why be kind? Why bother? Drowning feels nothing like this, I bet. Not that I'm good at imagining that particular tear, the swelling of the lungs, the pressure on the face, nor immolation. I recoil from even thinking about blistering flesh, the acrid stench of burning hair, nor a gunshot wound, torn flesh, mangled bone, but a stabbing, sliced veins, blowing, blood flowing fast over the clean edges of a deep, deep cut. That I know enough about already from shallow cuts here and there. I decided I'm not in love with him becomes I decided I fall in love with him, just like that, while I'm going to make myself a cheeseburger doesn't really change. Okay, so I'm going to read one more poem. And this is the only poem from the anthology. This is the first time I've ever read at Claremont, but it's the second time I was supposed to. I was supposed to read in March of 2010, but I was too sick to get on a plane. I have four infections. I had a middle ear infection in both ears, an inner ear infection in one ear, a chest infection, and an eye infection, and I had three different prescriptions for antibiotics, on top of which my mother was dying of cirrhosis of the liver, and I got to spend a little extra time helping her die, but it was just this horrible thing. I was supposed to meet Elisa. I was supposed to go have dinner with the Bushmans. I'd spent a year and a half planning this whole. I was one of the organizers and I couldn't go, but I knew it was some of my very last time with my mother. And then she died, and she had her entire funeral already planned. All we had to do was enter the date that she was out, partly because she didn't trust anybody to do it the way she wanted, and partly because she just wanted to save us the trouble. And she had me read poetry, and I read this poem at her funeral, and it's called Last Night's Fire. I've always felt I'm someone who could approach her own beheading with unvarnished resignation, no sprees of weeping or remorse, dressed if I were lucky in a murky red dress newly made by a servant who would miss me, if not, in a muslin shift worn fine and bleached by countless afternoons drying on mothy bushes. I'd acknowledge the crimes I'd committed without feeling I should have undone them, proclaim whatever innocence I possessed, and decline a blindfold, preferring to see the crowd and the scaffold and what was left of my future billowing out before me until a man I could only hope was strong raised a blade I could only hope was sharp and plucked the thread of my life so fiercely that it spooled immediately into a startling stuck tangle, and that was the end of that. It's what I'm doing now, envisioning an end and walking toward it, hoping it will be an endurable. That's so Mormon. My mom's death was really gross. So anyway, envisioning an end and walking toward it, hoping it will be an endurable, appreciated death. I admit I think we all deserve that, despite our collective likeness to the sweeping of last night's fire. But something precious, but always something precious, is burned with whatever fuel warms us and boils water for coffee in the morning and soup at night. Always some beautiful bright trinket that should have adorned the mantelpiece dissolves among the coals, its smoke mixed with the smoke of dead juniper or pine, and carried by the wind's hocus pocus to coat tomorrow's clouds with darkness and grime.
Now you get to hear from me again. Woohoo, right? I'll read few of my own poems.
Is it right?
Okay. Some from the anthology, a couple that are in limbo. And then I'll read some from some of the other poets in the anthology who couldn't be here because 82 poets up here and a few audience members would be kind of awkward. This is read this first poem. It's after Job 41:25. And it starts with a line from that verse. It's untitled, so live with it. By reason of breakings, they purify themselves. So Job. So flesh flung in Leviathan's wake, rolled loose soul in the infinite boil. So Leviathan, riffing off the riptide, cacophonous staves upwelling from the good book, selvage swart, with the fingerprints of sin's compulsive caress. Sin's legion is the ridge and whirl of waves spread horizonward from Leviathan's violent weave. Sin's thinnest spindrift, lustrous spit and prism, spun from the tangle of scale and sea. Sin's brazen as scales down compulsion's backside, whether tight, whether trim, weathered shiv and shimmer breaking on bodies blanched in the rush and boil of birth. It's kind of a backwards sonnet. So it's got a sestet, then an octet, if you know what that means. I don't know why I wrote it that way, but it happened. So, kind of an exploration of playing with language there. One of my abiding projects has been an ekphrastic engagement with the paintings of a Mormon artist named J. Kirk Richards. Now, ekphrastic is, anybody know what ekphrastic means? And you can explain it, because it's
oh, yes. This is like you commenting on the art and I know what it means.
It's basically just writing about a piece of artwork or in response to a piece of artwork.
And he's great. He's
Jacob like, Richards. Yeah, I love this. It's really powerful. It's got really good Christian iconography. It's kind of Catholic infused. He served his mission in Italy. So he's got a lot of that in there, Roman Catholic kind of thing. But this is on J. Kirk Richards' Stand of Trees. You don't have to have seen the painting to understand the poem, but I could show you, but I won't. So on J. Kirk Richards' Stand of Trees, I've been neglecting what it takes to piece together dawn from old snapshots and reminiscence faded as the blush from Adam's skin. When God's question stunned the garden and he slipped with Eve into the shadow of God's voice. Their shame a stand of trees backlit by cherubim. Come hounds obey to flush them into death, sin, recognition, solitude. A blood-drunk field, mantle deep with sweat and sorrow. Soil thick with the afterbirth of myth and tectonic histories. Pieces of a puzzle that shift in bed as I try to number them. One, two, three, no. One, two, one. Edges ragged as the blanket Cain has carried since he weaned him from the teat, and he found his thumb to replace it, but not enough to fill his hunger, not enough to keep serpents from burrowing into his need, from shedding that rag like yesterday's skin, from slipping him the switchblade he used to quarter the fruit he knew had ripened in mother's womb, the harvest he'll never find as he works his spittle and excrement field into bodies with hands red as Stygian clay. That's one really long sentence. So, the last one I'll read from the anthology called For the Man in the Red Jacket. This was an interesting experience I had out running very early one morning in the streets of downtown Ogden, which is kind of a scary place. And this guy came walking up toward me, had a red jacket on with his hood pulled up over his head. And as I passed him, he moved and reached his hand to grab something, and it scared me because I thought it would be a gun or something. Shows how much trust I have in humanity. But as he passed, he took his hat off and he turned and looked at me, and he asked me a question that really stuck with me. And this poem came out, well, I wrote it sometime after that. I don't remember how long it was. It took me some time to process it. But it's called For the Man in the Red Jacket. The epigraph is called The Waters Are Come In, from Psalm 69:1. His word, more than his face, remains, trailing me as the rain that stuck to my glasses and soaked my clothes, seeping through my windows, my facade, into the crawl space of memory. I see now he was serious. As we'd passed on the street, each moving the other way, he pulled off his red jacket hood and tried to make eye contact. "Have you necessarily taken the time," he'd asked, "to find out what grace is for?" Reluctant to break the rhythm of my run, I'd turn just enough to see him in my periphery, standing alone on the corner as the rain started, and said nothing. If he'd asked for money or the time, I might have slowed at least to tell him I didn't have any, or it's 6:22. But grace, I remember thinking, get serious, brother, and out of the rain. It's early, I'm running, we're about to be wet, and our garments as heavy as Genesis. Of course I've made time for grace. I'll read two more quick ones from me. One has a really, really long title. I had a fetish for about two poems writing really long titles. Didn't last. The second poem's not even finished yet. But this is called Upon Learning at 31 That My Astrological Sign Had Been Changed from Sagittarius to Ophiuchus. So it goes from right in that, there's a comma. I split my tongue, taste-testing the serpent-bearer's anapest. clave desire, tongue tracing the equinoctial groove, Linnea Negra long as the tracks on God's favorite LP, the adagios he composed and recorded while an intern in his dad's studio, the ones he still plays as he paints, flings timbral eons to the infinite corners of his canvas while he dances at the infinite edge, a slow-breaking two-step, his body long and low in divination's groove, flesh folded into movement, folded into universe, folded into the technique he picked up from Pollock when the artist came upstate for a show and gifted the creator his latest meditation. It's fractals spinning out and out till they shed the ground like so much paint, and God knit them into desire to clothe this uncertainty of a universe, to graft into the stories I recite as I wait to shed this womb and slip into the serpent's sidereal skin. Another really long sentence. And let's see. The last one I'll read is, I served my mission in New Zealand among the Maori. And one thing that I've had a, I don't know if you call it a fetish, just one thing that's really caught my attention about their culture is its focus, huh? It is a fetish, I suppose. It's called a koru. It's the unfolding fern leaf. And it looks really beautiful when you look at it. If you've ever seen an unfolding fern leaf before, but it's a huge part of their culture and it represents the idea of rebirth, regeneration, creation. And I started a series of sonnets based on the image of the koru and Maori culture, trying to break it up a little, infuse a little Maori culture with Christianity and things like that. So this is Koru Sonnet 1. Let's slip, you and I, into memory's inner coil, into reminiscence supple as slow passage into prayer as unfurling into birth. Let it spoon into the soul. Let it tap the flesh like, let it lap the flesh like fire. Flaming tongues, nested ripples, coaxing dawn from heaven's pit. Coaxing blood, breath, milk, myth, appetite from the porphyry's subtle gyre. Let's drift, you and I, beneath the porphyry's low. Let it lure us like thirst to the gods' iris pools. Let it bend us to drink. Let it bury the appetites, plunge them soul deep, release them into knowing, iridescent as the body's inner shell. The porphyry is a Maori greeting when you come up onto, it's called marae, where they have their meetings. It's a big courtyard out in front of their meeting house. They do a ceremony where they call you onto the marae, and they kind of challenge you. If you've ever seen a BYU football team, they do a haka, challenge their enemies to war. That's kind of the porphyry. It's a welcoming onto their land. So those are my poems. I'm going to read some from the other poets, from the few other poets in here. One being Paul Swenson. Paul actually passed away Thursday noon. He's been kind of a staple in Mormon letters for a while. He's had bad health for a while. But he passed away, which is kind of a surprise, at least to me, although I knew he'd had bad health. But I'll read one of his poems. Not sure which one. Called Woman on a Boat, a mission poem. She in her 40s, me barely 20, side by side on a ferry in a Gothenburg canal, dark hair under dark scarf, eyes covered by dark glasses, shows up in the photo as woman of mystery, smile as wide as the sea that would separate us. Cheap suit, Swedish knit, gives me away as missionary. Indecorous to address her by her given name, Majbrit, since my hand in her conversion, immersion in a new religion, brought her from the water as Sister Akerborg, washed of all her sins. Storyline gets thinner here. Letters burned with yearning for shining star to steer her life by. Don't know why I couldn't solve her questions, calm her fears. Letter ceased, sky closed in. Dark striations in the water of that Gothenburg canal compel a curious swell of old emotion. Is she still afloat out there between the ports of heaven and hell? Woman on a boat. So that's Paul. I'll read one.
So many good ones to choose from.
This one from E.S. Jenkins. It's called Weary. I counted them as they came, sons and daughters who didn't count. I counted their limbs, perfect limbs, like their father's, nothing so imperfect. I found him perfect, my one weak of us, my one weak husband. I knew, walking steps behind him, that we were only that weak, that I would give him and forgive him as my father gave him to her. I forgave, but forget her name, beautiful sister, in the names of my children, in the name of the Lord who heard me. I like how that poem circles around itself, like I'd imagine a woman being weary from childbirth, things like that. I think it reflects it well in that poem. Because I'm doing my dissertation on Alex Caldiero, I have to read one from him. The shortest poem in the book, so it will only take me a few seconds once I find it. Alex Caldiero. It occurs to me as I gaze on the splendid work that the Maker, too, stood in the very space I stand in, unfolding for all time. Amber Watson, Baptism. We're too made of water, water that dream of playing first, then running a cracked earth through of waiting. We ask for water to drink. It leaks through shoes, walls, glands, hands, and in falling, filling a kid's toy bucket, a garden pail, a lake. I wish I could remember water cold, a shudder and immersion. Was this a cleansing? Drowning? We take her carefully, one by a hand, and I with a hand covering her mouth. She floats, floats, sinks. A weightless fall, her left leg from her right, her back rolling after shoulders. From between my fingers she gasps, and I feel I am all there is between her and all that water. We'll do some Lance Larson. This one is from his book. I think it's his latest book, Backyard Alchemy. Anyway, Lance teaches at BYU. Yes, I was right, Backyard Alchemy. Excellent book. All of his three books are really excellent. It's called To the Lost One-Third. What should I call you? Devil spawn, Satan's imps, lost ones? Or do you prefer legion? Something elegant about that collective I, that singular we. And what of the Gadarene boy you possessed, who frothed and wailed, fell into fire, broke chains, cut himself with stones, etc.? Was he elegant? Of course, the tale came right eventually. The possessed one regained his mansion of organs and a mind swept clean. Jesus, who began as itinerant preacher, ended as Christ, casually morphing into light and truth and hopping a ship to the next town. Even the pigs you drove off the cliff drowned quickly and will one day resurrect, floating out of boiling waters like lemmings on rewind. But you, Legion, you have no body to home to. What keeps us safe from you? Crosses around the neck, holy water on the brow? Do the same unclean spirits haunt us for life? Looking for a breach, or do you switch at will? Greedy hitchhikers inventing your own route to Budapest. What is the body? It wheezes and grunts, prickles with heat, gobbles fetid air, slobbers like a dog after every passing lust, stares out windows into echelons of blue, drowns in pools of ether disguised as sleep. How can you want this cloven hoof part of me? We, you who remember all, but believe in nothing. What was it like before this life? Did we sing in that minestrone of waiting? Did you? Did we have godly names? I guess you can ask questions. Anybody have questions? Do you have a poem you want to read?
I'm curious, those of you who are, you know, getting your PhDs, and that's probably doing more of a cold run, the left brain processes right now. How do you maintain your right brain, the curiosity, the spontaneity, the creative side, when oftentimes your academic pursuits are so rational, you know, and so there's this kind of this tension that you work through. So how do you maintain your creative views in that process?
He's talking about me.
Yeah, where do we want to start? It feels like almost everyone.
You don't.
Yeah. You kind of hop back and forth.
Yeah, I think that tends to happen a fair bit, is that one or two things. You either retreat into one when you can't figure out how to deal with the other. I think that's
when you don't want to.
Or you don't want to touch the other one. Or the other thing that happens is, if you're lucky, you choose a critical focus that that instead inspires you to, like, provides fodder for what you're actually working on. And I've been lucky so far that my critical work deals with the same historical and thematic matter as what I'm working on creatively. So.
But it just fundamentally changes your work. I mean, it changes. Graduate work in the United States is designed to change your brain, and it does. It fundamentally changes the. You can write some new things, but there are other things you are no longer able to write. Mm-hmm. And that's how it's supposed to work.
Oh no!
seriously, maybe get out before the dissertation.
Too late now. I'm already too far.
Can't pay for it and not get the piece of paper.
No, he's just responding.
He's having the answer to her.
He's just responding because my last poem was a conversation between the left side of my brain and the right side. And the title of it was, I won't read it to you, it's too discouraging, My Heart Is Gone and I'm Angry.
I think I have one like that too. Yeah. Other questions?
I was interested when Karen said that she went into her office and wasn't able to do any creation, and then suddenly a poem came. I mean, does that happen to all you guys? Or has it happened? It seems like it intrigues me. How can you turn it on like that?
It was an accident.
Yeah, I'd say 9 out of 10 it happens the other way. They have to wrench it out of experience.
You don't turn it on, it turns itself on. Mm-hmm. You just try to prime the pump every so often and keep some of the channels and conduits open, and if you're lucky, something runs through it.
I'm interested that you said that, because that seems to me an outsider. There's no poetry in me whatsoever. But it seems to me that a situation like that, it would have to be a certain amount of luck involved, and here it is, here's your poem.
It's like you said, you were walking through that thing and you could just feel there was a poem there. You walking down the street, you know, you can turn life, but I guess that's a gift.
But you have to
extent. You can turn life into
take
that kind of expression.
And squeeze the poem out.
I think you can, go ahead.
Oh no, it's okay, I'll go.
You can keep writing. It doesn't mean what you're going to be writing is great. But like when I with Wittgenstein's Tractatus, I thought, okay, I'm going to take these aphorisms. I'm going to read Lorca at the same time. These are going to be a conversation between Lorca and Wittgenstein. And I let them be the poets so that I didn't have to worry about my own process. And poems came out of there. And granted, most of them were quite terrible. But a few of them were okay. And then other times when I've hit rock bottom in my creative process, like I'm really a huge fan of Zbigniew Herbert, a Polish poet, and I've taken his poems and I've rewritten every line. And then I'll go back and look at the lines and say, okay, which ones are any good, and can I make a poem out of them? And then other times I've gone and I've taken a poem that somebody else wrote. I had to rely on other poets. And I would invert every image and make every line the exact opposite of what that poet had said. And then I would go back to and look at those lines, and then maybe I'd say, oh, okay, okay, I can begin now. Or, and I have poet friends, and sometimes I think I'm not doing anything, and if I talk to them, and one of them will go, oh my gosh, that's the first line to a poem, you just said it. You just said it, that's great, you know. So you put that down, but I think right now I'm having a terrible struggle, but there are various ways in. I know most people, when I got an MFA in creative writing, they said that after 5 years, most people who get an MFA are no longer writing. So what you have to do is, so what I did is I would enroll in community college creative writing classes that friends of mine were teaching, just because the assignment made me write. And I think you have to, right now I'm too busy, so I can't do it because I'm doing this horrible rational thing that is that has eaten my, taken, the world is no longer enchanted for me, but if I were to go to creative writing class, a friend of mine was teaching somewhere to keep their enrollment high, and they thanked me. I would get assignments, and I would have to do them. And I think you have to discipline yourself to keep at it.
And you find tricks. I served my mission in Taiwan and learned Mandarin, and Chinese definitions have been very, very useful to me. Playing with Chinese dictionaries, I did that for a very long time. So you find little tricks to do, and it's not like you just sit around and wait. It's like, oh, I feel a poem. You have to be like, you have to be writing stuff along the way, so that you have, when the muse strikes you, you have something to help her along with.
Yeah, I would say, like, I had the opportunity to interview Lara Kosciuszko. I don't know if anyone's heard of her, but she's a poet and novelist, and she talked about it. She called it dance and disappear. But when you, like, she said, if I sit down and I try to write a poem, then it's terrible, you know. But if I just sit down and just start writing, just free writing, then it just, you know, it just sort of emerges. And last week I actually gave a poetry workshop for the young women in my ward, and they wanted me to make it spiritual at the end. And what I told them was that, like, anciently, poets and prophets were the same thing. That word was synonymous. Poets were prophets, prophets were poets. And in our religion, we believe that we have the gift of revelation. And so that way, just through the act of writing, I think things are revealed. You know, and it just the work, if you just keep working, then, you know, you'll clutch it. It'll happen.
Now, in sports,
when I was a college undergraduate major in English, I loved the cadences of poetry, but I could never write poetry. It was terrible any time I tried. But what I'm wondering, and that's one reason I came here, is to listen to those cadences. And while you were reading, I was generally kind of spaced. I wasn't looking at you. I was just kind of looking at the table, listening to the cadences. And what I wonder is, at this stage of each of you, where each of you are, do you work on structuring those cadences, or do they come to you somewhat naturally? At this stage, I'm not talking about early on, but just now. Yes.
I guess I'll start. Yes. I think it's a little bit of both. Some of the poets I know consciously structure cadence. They work within meter. They're very sensitive to sort of how it all plots out. For me, at least, I grew up listening to a lot of things. My dad used to read us Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales every Christmas. And so I got used to hearing the sound of the cadences of poetry. And I think that kind of became ingrained in me, that I liked the sound of spoken word. And so when I compose, I will write a line, and when I get stuck, I'll just, even in the act of composing, I just keep reading the lines out loud and listening to where it goes, and then figuring out what happens next. But for me, it's always been about the sound of the poem. So that's how I gravitate. I know some other poets work the opposite way. They haven't even heard the poem until it's done, and then they'll read it out loud to themselves to hear what it sounds like. But for me, at least, it's always been part of the process.
Yeah.
kind of the same way. I have to have the, it has to sound right, and it has to feel right. It's just kind of a, I don't know, kind of a sense I get when I'm writing. If I put a word in and it just doesn't feel right when I read it aloud to myself, and I go hunting for another one.
But I mean, the thing is, poets do that even when they write prose. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like it's such a deeply ingrained habit that, and then you know, I'm actually not a big Annie Dillard fan, but there's this, it's Living Like Weasels. There's this short little bit where, I mean, it's written as prose, but it's absolutely a poem. It's mm-hmm. It rhymes, it scans, mm-hmm. and even John Ruskin. I can't remember what it was, but there was this amazing line. It does not need much to humiliate a mountain. A hut will sometimes do it. And he's talking about, you know, landscape art and sticking an ugly building in the wrong place. Actually, in the mountain I grew up, they put the world's largest telescope on the top. It looks like a Walmart. This mountain. But I was reading it, and I thought it was a great line. And it you know, it scans, humiliate, do it. It's an off rhyme, and it scans, and so you not only do that in your poetry, you do that in your prose, and you notice it when you read both poetry and prose. That's one of the gifts that doesn't go away.
And the curses, as it were.
Yeah, we were just commenting about the fact that this is why it takes so long for a poet to write a dissertation. It's because when you're working on the critical stuff, you just keep focusing on the sound of the sentence instead of actually just getting the thoughts out. Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say that I have a total tin ear, and it took me like 2 years to figure out how to write in meter. I didn't even know like where the syllables fell. I had to look words up. So now it's sort of natural, but wasn't natural for me. I was one of those people who put things on poetry boards and everyone tore me apart because it wasn't right. So yeah, it wasn't natural for me.
I think even if you get a line, like I have one right now, Last Night Utopia Burned. I'm supposed to write that poem on the burning of the phylanstery at Brook Farm. I know I'm supposed to write it. I haven't done it yet, but just because I have that one line doesn't mean I have the others.
You don't have it anymore. You just shared it with me.
Yeah. Well, we should all write an anthology on the burning of Utopia.
Right, six different poems.
It could be a fun project. But anyway, just because you get one line doesn't mean the others are there. And I do think that they need to be beautiful. But for me, it's not just the cadence, it's the sound. So I'm always looking for assonance, and I'm always looking for alliteration. I'm always looking for syllables. I'm always looking for the way words are sounding. But then I also have this thing, I just truly hate beautiful language that wastes my time. and so poets are also looking for, I think, ways to, not all of them do, but I appreciate poems that mean, that's just me.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how to ask this. I've found poetry to be quite involuntary. That's the one thing I miss about being married. Apparently it was just enough irritation. I've been divorced now for 10 years, and I got nothing. And it kind of bothers me that the well has run dry. Any advice?
Put a pebble in your shoe.
Put a pebble in my shoe.
It's a little irritation.
Do you read lots of poetry?
Yeah.
And that doesn't help?
I was going to say, stop and read something else. Yeah. I find actually, if I'm stuck, I read nonfiction. And I'll pick something obscure and odd, like the history of watermarks. Or something like that, and it's, or what was it? Architecture for the Poor is some guy's treatise on sort of a proposal for how to solve housing issues in Egypt. And he's Egyptian, went to school elsewhere, and then he writes about it. But he interweaves into his commentary, you know, his critical stuff gets interwoven with these history moments and these literary moments. And it's actually an incredibly rich read. And so little things like that, you know, just off the wall, slightly out there, little text, will end up having me stumble across a line or an idea I hadn't thought about, and then I'll just make a note. And one of the best pieces of advice I had was actually from, we had a chance to hear, I think it was Ann Carson came and visited USC a couple of years ago, and she talked about the fact that she used to, during periods of time when she couldn't write at all because of, you know, things were just too busy, she would just write down a line and stick it in a drawer and forget about it. And just keep filling the drawer with lines. And then like 2 years later, when she finally had time, she opened the drawer. Yeah. And then she would just go through them and assemble things.
Huh.
And I thought that was a fantastic idea, because mm-hmm. sometimes that's all we have time for, is like an idea comes to us, but we don't have time to expand it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I like that.
The other, I mean, you know, I've had some pretty long dry spells myself, but some, I love Elisa's idea of taking a creative writing class, as especially one where if you have an MFA and it's a community college class, you probably will get some good stuff and plenty of crap, and so you won't feel too intimidated. But finding somebody who will exchange assignments with you, I have done that so many times of just begging a friend, will you come up with 6 writing assignments for me over the next 6 months? So I at least write, even if 5 crappy poems, maybe 1 decent one. And in fact, if you want, we can exchange email addresses and I'll do that with you.
Oh, so, Holly's such a sweetheart.
That's very nice. Yeah, because I think it's part of the, you got to get in a community. Most of my friends, I don't traipse it out much for fear of getting beaten up. I'm feeling a little bold. May I? Is this an okay venue to just try a short
read something? Awesome.
Yeah. Go for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've never done this before, and I don't know. I mean,
close your eyes.
I'm gonna close my eyes. I don't want to get laughed out, but I guess, I'm getting too old for this. I gotta just kind of go for it at some point, right? So this is called "But It's a Waterfall." Halfway up the trail, I sensed she was not there, pausing to wonder why mist gathered in my hair. We traveled very far to the solemn stony wall, less to be together than to see the waterfall. And the ferns blowing wildly in the dancing space where each molecule of water fell in furtive race. But today was wrong somehow. The magic was removed. I turned to discover that my new wife sat unmoved. I blinked to help me fathom what could keep her in the car when water, time, and space formed a miracle not far. I returned and asked directly, despite my marital training. With piercing, privileged eyes, she snapped, "It's raining," in such a tone as to imply it was I who was the fool to want to watch the water fly and settle in the pool. I turned my face skyward, but could scarce feel rain at all. And with the vision still in mind, I said, "But it's a waterfall." So back and forth we went until we'd simply said too much. The circles in our Venn diagrams didn't even really touch. I wish I could say the waterfall won, but alas, it did not. And half of us halfway up the trail was as far as we ever got. Looking back now, I find the irony still causes some pain. We missed the waterfall that day because of a little rain.
Thank you.
What do you... You publish. I don't even know what to do. You send these off to places. You send them back and forth to a friend, and then
you get somebody. You wait until you wait until you do all you can do to it yourself, and then you show it to somebody who will be like, "Eh, it's not as good as the one you showed me last month," or "This one's awesome," and then you find a journal online or in print, and you send it to them, and you wait. Anywhere from, if it's like the Beloit Poetry Journal, you get it back in a week, and they're like, And or I've had three years it took a journal to send me a rejection. It's like, why bother?
I just got one.
At that point, the book
got one
back
up from Crazy Horse after a year.
Yeah,
Crazy Horse. I just got a rejection after a year, but I think. In the meantime, they had sent a fundraising thing around, and I didn't join in. But, you know, I'm just really kind of tired of helping sustain the world of poetry and not getting a whole lot back in return. I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Those are ones you have to be careful of. The ones that are like, yeah, sure, we'll publish it. You just got to pay us $150.
Mm. Yeah. Right. Stay away from those ones.
Yeah.
So it's self-published, right?
No.
Nowadays, online.
No.
No.
No. Not if you
want to start a blog, find some commenters.
If you want a career in academia, or if you want to be taken seriously, or if you want to be reviewed, you don't self-publish poetry.
Yeah. What you can do though is you can find online forums that are relatively good workshop spaces, and I think. Do you know if this still is around? I used to use this a long time ago. The Yalsoff Review, do they still have, are you familiar?
Are you talking to me?
Well, yeah. Anyone okay. Down this
yeah.
Line, really.
I think they're still
there. Yeah. Yalsoff Review, so that's ALSOP Review. They have a forum, and there are like poetry workshop spaces in there. So basically, you set up an account with them, which is free. And since it's a password-protected entry into the forum, you don't have to worry about losing, you know, being considered officially published because it's in a protected forum space, so it's not public. And in that forum, you'll get feedback on poems. So you can post something and you'll get feedback from people. And some of them will be very nice, and some of them will be pretty brutal. And so you develop a thick skin, but it's good to develop the thick skin early. Because, and I think actually, in often cases, if you've served a mission, that's ample preparation for how it is. Because really, you get, like, some of my friends say that they're absolutely devastated when they get rejections. I say, I don't know, I spent 2 years being rejected. Which I want.
I know I'm not submitting enough poetry right now because I'm not getting a daily rejection letter in the mail. That means you're not submitting enough. I mean, if I were submitting like I should be, I'd be getting more rejection letters. So when you get them, you just say, great, I'm submitting. Send some more out.
I remember in high school, a writer in residence that came to my high school told us that when we started sending things out to wallpaper our walls with our rejection slips, so it was just there all the time, and just, you know, just accept it. And it was that... I don't know, that helped me early on. So, yeah.
And I think the other thing you can do is look around at the poets that you try to discover poets that you like, that you enjoy reading, and figure out how did they get their starts. You know, where did they publish to get started? And look at those type of places as possible venues for where you're sending your work. You know, if you like to write humorous poems, for instance, then look for poets that engage humor and work with humor and see where they publish. And if you like to write, you know, ekphrastic verse, then you might want to look at places that might have more of a focus on publishing art and art-related poetry.
Well, our time's up. I'm glad you kept everybody stayed awake. That was a bonus.
Thank you for coming.